You are listening to End of Life University Podcast, Real Talk About Life and Death. This is episode number 166. Welcome to End of Life University Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, hospice physician, author, and educator. In this podcast, I share thoughtful conversations with experts in various fields related to dying and death, and informative teaching sessions on preparing for the end of life by living fully today. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for joining me today for another episode. I am back from Spain, finally, from my travels, where I had an amazing time. And so finally, once again, I'm recording this episode in real time. And I'm going to be telling you today all about my trip and some of the observations I made while I was traveling through Spain. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But first, I have a couple of announcements. I wanted to let you know of an upcoming webinar, and it's actually going to take place. If you're listening to this as it's being broadcast, it will actually take place one day later. And you might be listening far later in time in the future, but I wanted to let you know about a webinar that I am sponsoring and hosting with Jane Barton, who's going to be talking about bridge time, the consequences of change. And her webinar consists of lots of information and tips for how to be more resilient in the face of change in later life, and also for those of us who are caregivers. And so Jane is quite an expert. She's a former hospice chaplain and quite an expert on caregivers and how to be supportive to caregivers. So I thought this was an excellent topic to talk about change and resilience and how we learn how to cope with change as we go through later life and are faced with aging, loss, grief. And so you can tune in to that webinar, and you need to register for it first to get the call-in information. And if you're listening to it again later on in the future, you can go back and hear the replay. So go to eoluniversity.com/Barton, B-A-R-T-O-N, and there's a page there where you can register for the webinar if you'd like to attend live. And if it's after the fact, you'll be able to listen to the webinar on that page, to the recording, and watch the slides from Jane. So I'm happy to be able to bring that to you as just part of the information that I want to offer to my audience and my listeners and followers. So every time I come across somebody that I think has something to share that might be of value, I'm really happy to put it out there for you, free of charge, just for your benefit. The next announcement is, as many of you know, if you follow the podcast for a while, support for this podcast comes from my page at patreon.com/EOLU. And that's a donation page where you can sign up to donate as little as $1 a month, a recurring donation to help support this podcast. And this week I have a lot of donors to thank because I wasn't able to do live episodes for the 4 weeks while I was traveling. So I'm catching up a little bit by mentioning all the donors who signed up during that time. I want to thank you so very much for your generosity and for stepping up to be a supporter. It really helps me financially to keep this show on the air and also the End of Life University interview series. But it especially helps me emotionally and spiritually to know that people out there are listening, that they enjoy what I'm putting out into the world, and that they'd like me to keep doing it. So today I'm thanking my supporters, Tanya Musser, Julie, Rowena Wallen, Isaac Siegel, and Alicia Coleman. And once again, thank you so very much. This means everything to me. If you would like to join the team and become a supporter yourself, you can go to patreon.com/EOLU and find out how you can start supporting the podcast and receive some special bonuses as a thank you. So as I mentioned before, this episode, I'm just going to do a little a little run through of my trip to Spain and tell you some of the take-home messages that I gathered from my trip there, because it was really fascinating and wonderful. And I want to talk to you about it because if you've listened to me in the past on these podcasts or you've read some of my blogs, you might know that one thing that I am committed to when I travel is what I call grief travel. And that is, I bring with me my own experiences of grief and an open heart and an open mind. And as I travel to different places, I seek out stories and information and history of grief in the countries that I visit and other places that I visit, because I believe that grief is one of the experiences that is shared by all humans, regardless of religion, culture, ethnicity, race, nationality. It cuts across all boundaries. Everyone who is human experiences grief, and in fact, we also know that animals in the animal kingdom experience grief as well. But grief is one of the things that I believe has the potential to unite us all as humans and helps us put aside all of the differences that we see between one another in order to recognize we share so much more than we differ on. We share the fact that we love, and we share the fact that it's painful when we experience loss. And so I really believe that one way for us to come together in these seriously divided times is to focus on our humanity, the humanity of our grief and our loss, and to spend some time sharing that grief and grieving together. So that's the basis of my idea of grief travel and why when I travel, I pay particular attention to the stories that I hear and the symbols that I see and the memorials that I see that have to do with loss. So I just wanted to share with you some of those, some of the things that I experienced on this amazing trip to Spain. We started our journey in Madrid, the city of Madrid. And one of the first things that we saw when we were there, we arrived at the Atocha train station where there is a memorial, the 311 memorial in Madrid. They had their own terrorist attack, which took place 3/11/2004. It was a coordinated attack on commuter trains coming into the Atocha station. And there is a memorial for the attack that has... which I was not able to enter because it's currently being repaired. I've seen photos of it. I could see it from the outside and I could look through the window. And there is a cone-shaped dome inside with a thin membrane through which light penetrates that has names of the victims and messages of condolence in the dome. But it is a very somber place. To view. Again, I was only looking in from the windows on the outside because it is in disrepair right now and it's being worked on, so I couldn't go inside the memorial. But it was very interesting to see that site and to connect with it over the experience we had in our own country here in the U.S. of 9/11 and the World Trade Center bombings, as well as the Pentagon and the flight that crashed that terrorist attack. The feeling of devastation and loss and overwhelm that I think all of us experienced, even if we didn't know someone who died in that terrorist attack of 9/11. That's something that I will carry with me forever. And so I could call upon my own feelings of shock and grief as I visited that memorial site in Madrid and connecting with understanding what people in that city felt as well, and when in the entire country of Spain, as they saw that terrorist attack happening on within their country, on their soil. And so that was one of the first profound experiences I had of connecting in that sense, connecting with that devastating, shocking loss of an attack that takes place coming out of the blue from nowhere, and the pain that was experienced over that loss. The next experience that I wanted to mention in Madrid was viewing a famous painting by Picasso called Guernica. This painting is housed in the Reina Sofia Museum in Madrid. And I'll tell you the story of Guernica. The painting depicts a bombing raid that was done in the town of Guernica, which is in the Basque area of northern Spain, during the Spanish Civil War in 1937. The bombing was conducted by Hitler's forces, who were actually practicing their techniques of bombing, techniques that would later on be used in the blitzkriegs that were carried out by the Nazis during World War II. And this happened during the Spanish Civil War, when the nationalist faction, which was being commanded by General Francisco Franco, were opposed by the Republican forces of the country, which were made up of several different groups that came together in order to fight the fascist nationalistic regime of Franco. And so during the Civil War, Franco gave permission to the Nazis, who were his same cohort in a way, to bomb the town of Guernica as a practice run in order to test out their bombing methods. Guernica was a rural market village. They bombed on market day in the town at 4:30 in the afternoon. The bombing lasted somewhere between 2 and 3 hours. The reports of how many casualties occurred in that village vary. There's controversy over how many people actually died, but anywhere between 200 casualties to 1,700 casualties have been mentioned, and I believe it was difficult to get an accurate number because the city, about three quarters of the buildings in the city were completely destroyed. There was rubble everywhere. There were bodies buried, literally pulverized, and they had a difficult time counting the number of casualties. There was also dispute and sometimes denial over casualties. But in addition, it was estimated that about 900 people were injured in that attack. So again, this was an attack that was part of the Spanish Civil War, carried out by Nazis from Germany as a practice run for them, but a strategic move for Franco's forces during the Spanish Civil War, which ultimately, if you know your history, Franco won, and he ruled there as a fascist dictator until his death in, I believe, 1975. So this was a devastating attack on a small village, the village of Guernica, and when Pablo Picasso learned of it, he had already been commissioned to do a painting for this large expo that was going on, and he decided to make the subject of his painting the village of Guernica. And so, if you know, Pablo Picasso is a surrealist painting, so he uses these kind of bizarre surrealist figures in the painting. So I got to see the live painting in the actual painting in the Reina Sofia Museum. And it was an incredible, emotional, powerful experience to stand in front of it. This painting is 11 feet tall, 25.6 feet wide. It's huge. The figures are all done in primarily black and white with some blue figures. And it's so compelling and so dramatic to see this massive painting where he depicts people and animals in the painting as the bombing is happening. And so on one part of the painting, we see a woman who's holding a limp child in her arms and screaming up at the sky. There's also a woman reaching out of a window in shock and horror, you can see on her face. There's a dead soldier lying on the ground in the painting. The images are just, they're compelling, they're brutal, and they portray so vividly the shock and the pain that was experienced in the town of Guernica when that bombing happened, but also experienced by the entire country, the brutality of that bombing. Now, historically, in the years following 1937, there were many other similar bombings of cities that took place during World War II, and including the dropping of the atomic bomb by our country against Japan. So other devastation similar to this devastation in Guernica occurred in the years afterward, but this was one of the first times this had been witnessed, where an entire village was literally nearly wiped out. There were many survivors because they had enough time. Church bells rang out before the attack started. They were able to get into shelters underground. So there were survivors who lived through it. And apparently one of the few last survivors of that attack is still alive. I read an interview that someone had done with him, I think last year. So I'm hoping that he's still alive now, talking about that bombing. But at any rate, to see Picasso's portrayal of the bombing of Guernica in this massive mural painting that fills up a huge wall, it's the only painting in this room at the Reina Sofia Museum. And it's stunning and upsetting and disturbing and painful to see it, but it portrays so clearly the pain of war and the pain of loss and death that occurs in war. And if any of you ever have a chance to view that painting in real life, to stand in front of it, I would urge you, don't pass it up. Don't pass up the chance. See it if you possibly can. It's very compelling. I did not visit the village of Guernica, which is now, I guess, contains a peace museum and a peace park. It's become a symbol for peace in many ways. It's been rebuilt, although there are still parts of the city that show the effects of the bombing. But I wasn't able to visit the village, but I did see the painting, and again, it was a profound experience. So as part of my grief travel, that got me off to quite an interesting start, seeing the memorial at the train station and the painting of Guernica, and really vividly experiencing the aftermath of terrorist attacks and war, the effects that it has on us and on our psyche, and the pain of that loss and the grief that we all share as humans, even when we envision the suffering of other people and of another country, it connects us, and it's a powerful experience. So that's how I started my trip to Spain in Madrid. We spent a day in Toledo, a city south of Madrid, where some of the Spanish Inquisition took place in that city. It's a very beautiful old city, really fascinating and really wonderful to see. And from Toledo, we went on to Sevilla, to the little tiny town of Arcos de la Frontera, which is one of the Pueblos Blancos, the white hill towns along the southern end of Spain. From Sevilla, we started on a bike trip, which lasted 1 week and took us through the cities of Córdoba and Granada. And so during my days from Toledo to Sevilla to Córdoba to Granada, one of the things that I was really impressed with, I was learning about how for approximately 700 years off and on, from around sometime in the 8th century up until 1492, there was a population of Muslims, Christians, and Jews who lived together in these areas of Spain, not continuously in all areas, but during this time, it's called the convivencia, which means, I believe, living together or, living life together. Muslims, Christians, and Jews lived side by side in these communities and shared culture to a certain extent, shared food, shared poetry, shared architecture and art. And it was really fascinating to learn about the time and to see Christian churches that had Moorish architecture and Moorish art and design in them. We also viewed a Jewish synagogue that was very Moorish. In fact, Muslim laborers had built much of the Jewish synagogue and were responsible for this beautiful like lace work on the walls. Incredible, very beautiful. And to see how people of these different religions came together during that time, they were neighbors, they lived together, they shared things together. And still today, you can see the influences of the three cultures and how they have blended together. It was fascinating to me. And I loved hearing the stories about it. I loved hearing about how those 700 years, and it was 700 years of Muslim rule on the Iberian Peninsula in Spain, not that it was always peaceful, not that there was always an accord, because humans are humans, and so I'm sure that there were plenty of conflicts that took place during that time. But those years, that 700 years of the convivencia, happened to be a really remarkable time for advances in science, medicine, astrology, literature, poetry. And the Muslim community was responsible in many ways for these advances that were made in medicine, including surgery and pharmacology, also in agriculture and irrigation techniques. They were very sophisticated. So those years of relative peace and relative cooperation between the civilizations resulted in a great deal of advancement, which was taking place at the same time as the Dark Ages in the rest of Europe. And so while the rest of Europe was floundering a little bit during these years, there was this advancement that was being made in Spain because of this collaboration and this synergy, in a way, of different cultures coming together. I found it fascinating, beautiful, amazing. In the city of Cordoba, we were able to visit the Mesquita, which was the largest mosque that had ever existed. A huge, massive mosque, very beautiful inside, filled with red and white arches throughout the mosque. Amazing place to take pictures because there are all these overlapping arches, and it's like a forest of arches is what they call it. Absolutely beautiful inside. That mosque, mezquita is the Spanish word for mosque. That mosque, when the Christians took over in 1492 after the Reconquista, and the Catholics moved in. Actually, the Reconquista ended in 1492 in Granada, which is when the last Muslim rule was ended in 1492 in Granada. But I believe Christian rule came to Sevilla or came to Cordoba earlier than that, perhaps 200 years earlier. I was trying to get all my facts straight here. But when the Catholic dynasty moved in to Cordoba, they did not tear the mosque down, which actually happened in most of the other cities where mosques had existed. When the Catholic rule came into the area, the mosques were torn down and Catholic cathedrals were built on the same site and the same ground. And so there were many other places where we saw cathedrals that were built on top of former mosques, and sometimes you could see remnants of the mosque. But we also learned those mosques were built on sites where previously Christian Visigoth churches had existed that had been torn down in order to build the mosque. And the Visigoth churches had actually been built on sites where Roman temples had existed before that time. So here on one piece of ground, you could see layers of civilization's creation, mankind's creation of religious spaces, layer after layer. And so so it was fascinating to see the layers of time and how each new conquering culture comes in and builds their own monument to their faith right on top of the same space where the previous culture had built their sacred spaces. So that was fascinating to be able to observe those layers and see that history in front of our eyes. But what was unique about the mezquita in Cordoba is the fact that they did not tear the mosque down. It was a huge mosque and so beautiful and so amazing inside that they actually built the cathedral in the middle of the mosque. So they removed part of the mosque and the arches in order to put the cathedral inside, but they incorporated the mosque and the beauty of the mosque into the cathedral. So there's this vertically rising cathedral coming out of the middle of a horizontally spreading huge mosque. It's very fascinating to get to see the Muslim mosque and the Catholic cathedral coexisting in this space. And we were told by our guide that today everyone refers to it as the mezquita, the mosque, even though Islam is no longer being practiced there. It's the mosque is still the structure surrounding the cathedral, but instead of referring to it as the cathedral, they call it La Mezquita, the mosque. And she said, everyone wants to be married in La Mezquita. So, and everyone talks about it that way. It's just the mosque, La Mezquita, in the city of Cordoba. It's again, stunning, very beautiful, something it's a must see if you ever have the chance to go to Spain to visit it. And again, it's just fascinating when you see such a close juxtaposition of two religions in one space, even though Islam is not being practiced within that mosque, but was in the past. And so it's really fascinating to walk through it and just experience the architecture and see the differences and feel it, even feel it viscerally in a way, the differences in how humans have built structures to support their religion and to promote their religion, to support their religious life. So fascinating, La Mezquita in Cordoba. And the next city that we visited is Granada, and Granada was the last stronghold of Muslims in Spain. There was the Nasrid dynasty persisted in Granada up until 1492, which was when the Reconquista, the movement to reconquer Spain for Catholicism, had been taking place and pushed ahead by Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. And in 1492, they took over the Alhambra, which was the palace and the surrounding grounds and surrounding living space, I guess you could call it, a walled area of the city in Granada. The Alhambra was the where the Nasrid dynasty resided. And so that included the Sultan, I guess you would call him, and then all of the lower monarchs in that dynasty, and also all of the workers and all of the other Muslims in the area lived within this walled village, the Alhambra. So we got to visit it. The Alhambra, also such a beautiful place that when Ferdinand and Isabella took it over in 1492, they did not destroy it, neither did their offspring. They wanted to preserve the beauty of it, so you can still visit the Alhambra Palace and walk through it and see the gorgeous fountains that are there, the gardens, the Summer Palace. Very beautiful and very incredible. So this was turned out to be a really interesting story, because it was in Granada that a lot of pieces began falling in place as I listened to the guide talking about some of the history in that area. And I'm just sharing this with you because I'm fascinated by it all. So all over Spain, wherever we visited, we saw statues and monuments to Christopher Columbus. And we were also in Spain on Columbus Day, October 12th, which is a national holiday in Spain. And Columbus is very celebrated and still viewed as a hero in that country, even though, you know, so we were there on Columbus Day and seeing the celebrations in Spain around Columbus Day. And at the same time, I was reading on Facebook and in the news from the U.S. about the indigenous people celebration that were taking place in the U.S. as we are gradually diminishing our celebration of Christopher Columbus. So anyway, it was fascinating to see that contrast. I was really interested with the fact that to Spain, Columbus and his exploration was kind of a breakthrough that let Spain gain prominence in the European world as a country of, it let them become more colonial and have territories in other countries that they had power over, also to find riches in other countries that expanded their wealth and their prominence in Europe. And so Columbus, in their eyes, was truly a hero. Though, from our perspective, being the country that was populated by indigenous peoples and then had disease introduced, and actually not even on our shores, Columbus was actually on some islands in the Bahamas, but nonetheless, we no longer find Columbus a hero to celebrate in our country, as we have looked at the truth about his explorations and the impact that it had on indigenous people in our country and in some of the other islands where he landed. But nonetheless, in our travels, we did get to visit in Sevilla. We got to see the tomb where Columbus is buried, which is really beautiful and amazing. It's a massive bronze sculpture of four men. They're each wearing the uniforms and the garbs of the four different regions of Spain that came together to form Spain. And they're holding, they're like four pallbearers that are carrying a coffin, and Columbus's remains are actually inside this brass coffin that they're carrying on their shoulders. It's really spectacular. I've never seen anything like it before. That's in Sevilla, so I got to see that. When we were in Granada, we actually stood in the room in the Alhambra. It's in the Sultan's palace, and the Sultan's throne room is the actual room where Columbus met with Isabella and petitioned her for the final time for money to finance his voyage, supposedly to the East Indies. And we were actually standing in the room where Columbus spoke with Isabella and talked to her in that room. In Granada, there's also a statue that recreates this moment of Columbus, Isabella sitting on the throne and Columbus standing before her, talking with her. And we learned that initially Isabella said no. Columbus had petitioned Isabella and Ferdinand before in the past, and they had also turned him down because they were involved in the Reconquista, trying to drive out the Muslims and spending all their money on this war and battles. When Columbus came back the final time to petition them, the Reconquista had ended, and now the Muslim Nasrid dynasty had moved, had left, surrendered and left in exile. And Ferdinand and Isabella had taken over the Alhambra and were temporarily living within that palace. And that's why it was in that room where we were visiting that Columbus spoke with Isabella. She initially told him no, and Columbus left and was on his way back to Cordoba when Ferdinand convinced Isabella that they needed to go through with Columbus's plan. They needed to back him up and make an agreement with him and help him do his exploration. So they dispatched some messengers who left on horseback from the Alhambra Palace in Granada, followed Columbus, and they actually met up with him on a bridge, an old Roman bridge that was near the town of Santa Fe in Spain. Now, what's fascinating to me about this is on our bike trip, we got to actually ride past that bridge and see the bridge, and we rode through the town of Santa Fe, which is where the agreements were signed between Ferdinand and Isabella and Columbus for his voyage, his initial voyage. So all of that, I'm just saying it was really interesting. We got to actually visit the places where some of this history happened. And even though here in the U.S., Columbus is no longer viewed as such a hero, the truth has come out that he was a tyrannical leader in some ways when he was the governor of some territories. We know that he committed some atrocities. He had slaves. We know that there were a lot of negative aspects to Columbus. And some people in Spain are beginning to talk about that as well, that maybe we shouldn't be glorifying this man so much. But at least for me, it was fascinating to be there, to see the monuments, to be in historical places where these things actually happened and actually have a chance to stand there and view it myself. And that's the really interesting thing about travel. It allows us to see history with our own eyes and even touch it, to even touch these places where things happened in the past. And so these are my stories from Spain and some of the really interesting things we got to see and experience while we were there. We ended our trip in Barcelona. And Barcelona happens to be the place when Columbus had finished his initial voyage, where he ended up sailing into Barcelona, and Isabella came there to meet with him to hear about his journey, which was a disappointment, though. He had promised to bring back gold and riches and did not find any gold on that, on his trip, ended up bringing back some slaves, which Isabella rejected and wasn't interested in, apparently. The final story for Columbus is that he ended up falling out of favor with the Spanish court. And from what I read, he died a poor man and in dispute with the royalty of Spain over money that he had expected to earn in repayment for his explorations and from the agreement that they signed. But the royalty of Spain had decided not to pay him because he had been such an incompetent leader when he was given a position of being a noble over some of the territories that he reigned. So anyway, Columbus had his own sad end and died at the age of 54, impoverished and really in disfavor, and probably having no idea that one day he would be celebrated, and he was celebrated in our country for a number of years, but that's no longer the case in many of our communities, but still happening in Spain. And Columbus died without knowing that that was going to happen. Here's another interesting tidbit is that Picasso's Guernica was not displayed in Spain until he vowed that neither he nor his painting would ever set foot on Spanish soil while Francisco Franco was in power. And so Guernica was not in the country of Spain for many, many years after it was painted. It was brought back to Spain after Franco's death, but sadly Picasso died about 3 years before Franco did, so Picasso never got to see his painting come back to Spain, and Picasso himself never got to return to his home country of Spain because he died before Franco did. So another sad story, but again, I'll just reiterate, I find it fascinating to be open-hearted and open-minded and to be able to go and hear these stories about life and death and conflict and collaboration, about faith, about just history, learning about how we have lived together, how we have conflicted with one another, and how we have found ways to collaborate and come together and make the world a better place also. So my trip to Spain was very fruitful for me in that regard. Thanks for listening, if you're still listening. This is like a big travelogue and not like the usual things that I talk about, but I wanted to share it with you and to encourage you as well to do your own grief travel no matter where you go, even if you're just visiting the next town over or another state in this country, or if you do get a chance to go outside the country, outside of our borders and go somewhere else, keep in mind that you're looking for little clues and signs and stories of how people in those countries have dealt with their own challenges and dealt with their own grief experiences and dealt with the end of life. Many, many times I visit cemeteries when I'm traveling. On this particular trip, it was packed so full of other things that we needed to see. I didn't get a chance to go to any cemeteries, but I plan to go back to Spain. There's much that I didn't see when I was there, so I will go back, and probably on my next trip I'll have more time to visit some cemeteries, which is also a really fascinating way to get in touch with history and to get a feel for how people live with their grief and live with death and dying. So, thank you for listening if you're still here, I'll let you know you can go to my Instagram account if you want to see some of my pictures from Spain. I have posted quite a few of them there. I posted them while I was in Spain. And so it's KWyattMD on Instagram if you'd like to see some of my pictures. And I'll try to stick a few of them in the show notes when I get those written too at eolupodcast.com. Just look for episode number 166. And meanwhile, thanks again, everyone. Thanks for being hanging in there for those 4 weeks while I wasn't here doing live episodes. And there will be a new episode every Monday, so stay tuned, and I'll be back with something interesting next week. And until we talk again, remember to face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings your way, and love your life, love the life you have right now in this moment. I'll see you next week. Until then, take care and goodbye.